Jack's in love with a campus queen.
If I just had the guts to show her my stuff.
But her boyfriend doesn't believe the pen is mightier than the sword.
Let's see if you can draw with hamburger for a hand.
So Jack's gonna sketch up a little revenge. By entering Freddy's drawing room.
Where I'm sure he'll find plenty of inspiration.
On the next Freddy's Nightmares.
Uh-oh. We're back.
We are.
We're back in Springwood.
That we are.
And it's concerning, I think.
I think it's a bit concerning. Just a tad.
I am your co-host, Enrique Couto, here with my co-host, Double D, David DeNoyer.
Hello.
And it should be Triple D, but I guess your parents just weren't brave. What's your middle name again?
Lewis.
Oh,
named after my grandfather.
With a W or OU?
OU.
OU. So you're David Louis DeNoy. Oh, yeah. My God. DLD.
DLD.
Everybody? Oh, it's happening. It's happening. David Louis DeNoyer.
This is not the first time I've told you this.
I know, but it's the first time I listened.
That's fair. That's totally fair.
So we're here today. We've got all kinds of fun Springwood shenanigans for you all.
Chaos.
Oh, yeah. It's pronounced chaos.
Chaos.
But I'll allow it. And because we're talking about season one, episode 18, The Art of Death.
The Art of Death, indeed. And this episode is written and directed by Ken Wiederhorn. We've said that name many a times before, and we said it last week, of course.
Well, it's so fun to say.
Yes.
Wiederhorn.
Wiederhorn. He is the director of Freddy's Tricks and Treats, Sister's Keeper, and then in the film department, he has done Eyes of a Stranger, Return of the Living Dead 2, and of course, as we mentioned before, Shockwaves.
I like how you just gloss over Return of the Living Dead 2. Do you remember?
How could I forget? Like, how could I forget?
You tell the story and I'll just interrupt a lot.
So Henrik and I had just completed a Stepfather marathon, which consisted of Stepfather 1-3 in the remake. And at that point I can't remember if we were deciding on another movie or if I was getting ready to go and something.
No, we were deciding on another
movie. We had like three,
I think it was only like 9:30 or something.
And you threw out the quote that was, I think it was, is it cancer if we're lucky?
Oh yeah. That's one of my favorite lines from Return of the Living Dead 2. Yeah. Is it cancer?
If we're lucky.
I want to a biopsy.
And I asked you what that quote was from, and you kind of dead-eye stared at me for a second. You're like, you're kidding, right? And I was like, no. And that's when I confessed to you that I had never seen any of the Return of the Living Dead sequels because I'd only heard the first one was good.
But this is David, the man who worked at a video store
yeah.
for years and years, went to film school, allegedly, and loved movies,
especially
more
horror.
Than anything.
And yeah, I'd always heard that it wasn't that great, so I never seeked it out. I'd seen bits and pieces of Three, because Three, of course, has, I can't think of her name right now, but the goth chick in it.
So you had to check that one out.
Well,
Born Under a Hot Topic Moon, David DeNoyer.
That one played on sci-fi a lot.
David Louis DeNoyer.
That one played on sci-fi a lot. But yeah, no, Return of the Living Dead 2, so you sat me down and played...
Like a teenage son
who
needed to be put in his place. I was like, son, today you need to learn about life and you need to learn about the living dead.
And you also made it especially a special for me. Can't talk. God.
I know you can't.
Anyway, you made it special for me because the rip that you had the original soundtrack, which wasn't included on that DVD that released, because by this point we didn't have the Blu-rays of any of them yet.
So for those uninitiated, Return of the Living Dead and Return of the Living Dead 2 both had some soundtrack issues in their home video releases. It's why to this day, working in the film business now, when you do any license, it will say, you know, you're licensing it for television, streaming, DVD, Blu-ray, and then it'll say, and any formats to ever be invented.
Yep.
Because a lot of these bands, especially on Return of the Living Dead 1, it was much worse on Return of the Living Dead 1. I don't actually know the story of why 2 had such a messed up soundtrack, but on Return of the Living Dead 1, a lot of the bands were like, oh, well, if you need our music, we want to negotiate a new license. You pay us again. Because that movie was IRS Records.
IRS Records,
was where most of the music came from. So because of that, you had all kinds of weird song replacements. And to this day, the Blu-ray is not entirely
missing like one or two, I want to say. Well, still.
And like one of the songs was replaced with an instrumental of yeah. that song. It's
well, and then
weird.
Return 2 was replaced with like all that like weird
it was like weird
music
synth
theme
yeah. music.
Yeah.
I think that that might have been an issue with the master or
Could've
something.
Been, yeah.
But they did restore it. But no, so I had, and still do,
yeah.
a DVD copy of Return of the Living Dead 1 and Return of the Living Dead 2, which were the DVD rips at the time, which yeah. were the highest quality there was, but with the sound from the VHSs,
original, yeah,
which had the original, because when the contracts were signed, VHS existed. So they had the license. So this is the one. This is a way to basically say, kids, don't ever trust musicians.
No,
they're not honest.
And honestly, it's also a good point to bring up that if you're ever wondering why a lot of films, in particular, with such really great soundtracks, or just had either original themes and whatnot, haven't been released or get released with those different tracks, it's still because of the legal issues.
That's
with them.
Not as common a problem as television shows.
Television shows, because, especially TV, like Daria.
Well, not just, I mean, like Daria, like Married with Children.
Married with Children,
like.
Had it the first season, shows. Though. Married Children had it the first season.
Yeah, they
season.
Paid for it.
Yeah.
they didn't pay that, for it after that.
Then after that, no.
Well, because the license they got said broadcast mm-hmm. and maybe said VHS. I doubt it. But this was when television was ethereal.
Yeah.
It just came out and went away. And now we are back to Freddy's Nightmares. Now, I want to remind you.
Yes.
I'm trying to always mention this at the beginning of every show. As of the recording of this, if you are in the United States of America or using a VPN, USA or VPN, those are the three letters. You can watch Freddy's Nightmares with commercials free of charge on Tubi TV, and that's where we're watching yes. our program. So,
shall we get into it?
No, because Ken Wiederhorn has set us off on a whole other tangent. No, but that being said, I always liked Ken Wiederhorn's work, but I always heard he did not like making horror movies.
He didn't have a great time with Shockwaves, if I remember correctly.
He didn't want to make it.
Didn't want to make it, yeah.
He was friends with the people who financed it.
Okay.
Famously, I don't know if I could tell the story. Okay, I'm going to leave names out, because I have a first-hand story about Shockwaves, or a second-hand story about Shockwaves.
Yeah.
So I have a friend who worked on Shockwaves as a photographer,
uh-huh.
a set photographer, worked for free. A very well-known director now.
Uh-huh.
And who was it that was in that? Was that Peter Cushing?
Peter Cushing. Yeah.
Well, this friend of mine was like amped.
Yeah.
Because Peter Cushing was there.
Yeah.
And he went to hang out with Peter Cushing and realized that no one was hanging out with Peter Cushing. Like Cushing
oh,
was
wow.
just by himself in his trailer because no one knew who he was.
Oh, shit.
They just knew that he was a big name in horror because
yeah.
the money behind it and the director behind it, none of them were
yeah.
that into horror. So I almost said his name. My friend, I just don't know if I should tell that story
yeah,
or not
yeah, yeah.
without, you know, without warning him. I'm going to throw it into the ether. But yeah, they just didn't know much about him. They just knew
wow.
that he would sell tickets.
Yeah.
They hired him. And that was during a period when he'd work with, you know, just about anybody.
Yeah, early 70s. So yeah, he'd done a lot of the Amicus
I mean, you,
Hammer at that point.
You could do worse than a free trip to Florida.
That's true.
You know, and some Nazi zombies. So anyway, but no, I always like Ken Wiederhorn's work, even though I haven't heard much positive about him from back then.
Yeah.
He seems pretty cool now.
Yeah. Hell yeah. All right. So we are diving into The Art of Death, season one, episode 18. Original air date was March 12th or 13th, 1989. And like we said, written and directed by Ken Wiederhorn. Our episode opens as we meet Jack, who is played by Kerry Scott. He was on Making the Grade in 1984. He has an appearance in The Burbs, Joe Dante's The Burbs in 1989, Silk Stockings, Walker, Texas Ranger, and he's currently on the show Winning Time, the Showtime show.
Oh, and you said Joe Dante's The Burbs?
Joe
so
Dante's
not Tyler
the Burbs.
Perry's The Burbs?
Not Tyler Perry's The Burbs.
Oh, well, that's the one I've seen.
So Jack is explaining about a reoccurring dream he has where he comes to school and he's happy.
I know, which is clearly a nightmare. The moment I heard him say, I come into school and
I'm
happy,
happy,
I was like, well, that's not real. You are clearly dreaming.
So he is explaining that he's happy. The halls of the school are at first bare, but there's the sound of students who suddenly fade into the halls all around him. Jack continues that his dream he has is his he has his best work under his arms as he's a sketch artist, and he says it's all for her. Talking about a cute girl named Joan, who's played by Laura Schaefer. She was in Ghost Town from 88, Catacombs in 88
like
as
Ghost
well.
Town.
Ghost Town's fun. I think Ghost Town's pretty underrated, and I'm happy that it finally got a Blu-ray release from Shout a few years
that's
back.
That's the one with the Yeehaw skeleton
yes.
on the cover. I mean, that's a memorable
oh, yeah.
cover.
Hell yeah. So she goes on to he goes on to say that she will love him as much as he loves her. Suddenly, Jack is naked in the halls and adds, "That's when the dream turns to crap."
I mean, I think that's when the dream just starts to get good.
Yeah. So Jack is now seated outside the school with his buddy Pete. That is played, but he's played by Stuart Fratkin. He was in Girls Just Want to Have Fun, Valley Girls, Sledgehammer, Teen Wolf 2.
Wait, he was in Sledgehammer?
Sledgehammer, the TV show.
Oh, the TV show. The TV I thought you meant that SOV movie. No. That's why I was like, whoa. You can't just gloss over one of the most bizarre shot on video movies.
But the
of
last
all time.
Two I did want to mention, Pre-Hysteria. Again,
I love Pre-Hysteria. It's about little dinosaurs
and Tremors the series.
Well, I'm just I'm leaving. I am leaving. No, that is a career.
Yes, that is quite a career. So he tells him to make the dream better next time. Imagine Jones naked instead.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, and he's not wrong.
So Jack goes on to say he's made 357 drawings of Joan, spends half the night drawing them and the other half holding them with one hand.
And there are seriously not enough masturbation jokes in
There's
this show.
Really
I'm
not.
Really glad they managed to pull one off.
Huh?
Like when you pull on a penis to pleasure yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Through masturbation, David.
Pete asked
David,
him.
Masturbation.
Pete asked him if he's wanting to go blind, which I did love. Jack responds, no, but he wants her, and Pete tells him to ask her out. Jack adds he can't do it due to Joan having a boyfriend who's bigger has bigger arms versus his toothpick arms.
He is a scrawny,
he's scrawny
punk, yeah.
Pete tells him that he needs to forget him and show her the talent of Jack's drawings, which he'll feature in Peter's underground newspaper called No Mercy.
And I have to say, what woman would not be attracted to A, number one, a cartoonist?
Yes.
And A and B, number two, an underground zine cartoonist in college in the Midwest.
Midwest, yes.
You know, it's not like he's R. Crumb or something.
No, he is not.
I think he's got this in
he's
the bag.
He's got it set up, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I mean, literally, he'll have to put her in a bag and re-educate her.
Like Borat with Pamela Anderson.
Oh, exactly. My life.
So his plans for the paper are to explode every campus tradition, cliche, especially those blockhead jocks. Jack tries to argue that the jocks aren't the kind to take jokes well, and he doesn't do cartoons, but Pete soon convinces him that doing his cartoons will help him build his confidence.
You know what's worse than jocks?
What is that?
In college?
What?
People who complain about jocks in college.
That's totally fair.
I once met a guy who complained about jocks. He was like, there are all these preppies and jocks. And I looked him dead in the eye. And I was like, you're 26.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
You're 26, man.
And complaining about jocks.
And preppies. Like when he was literally like, there's a lot of preppies here. I was like, you mean people?
Yeah.
In their clothes, like going to work? Or?
I went to an art school and we did not have really any jocks there. We were all kind of a pretty connected clique for
an
the most
art
part.
School. An is art that what school. They called it?
That's what they called
what
it.
What was the name of the school that had the lawsuit?
Art Institute of Ohio Cincinnati.
Oh, it was an Art Institute. Okay. No, I didn't remember the name. I just remembered the litigation element. If you're listening to this, take a drink. We brought up David's education.
So his plans for the paper, like I said, are explode every tradition, including the blockhead jocks. Jack doesn't want to do it because he's concerned about the jocks. Later in the school's gym, Jack sits a few feet away from Joan, watching her work out and sketching a rendition of her as a warrior, which gave me Terrifier 2 vibes, like, immediately.
I worry about you, Dave. I mean, don't get me wrong. I enjoyed Terrifier 2 as much as I can enjoy any movie that incredibly grisly and violent. Hey, no. The Hen Man is not a big gorehound.
No, I know.
That's all.
Yeah.
So I just want to make it very clear that I enjoyed the film.
Yes.
But it's not in my
wheelhouse
oeuvre of where I would watch.
Yeah, I get that.
But that being said, I don't think you're well if you're thinking about it a lot.
So he sits a few feet away, sketching her as a warrior. Joan catches sight of him drawing and makes her way over to Jack, asking if the drawing is her. This startles Jack, and he tries to deny it, and he says he's just doing a sketch for fun. But Joan seems genuinely impressed by the drawing and admits it's how he sees her.
Well, I mean, nothing gets a chick going like cartoons.
Cartoons.
It's true. I mean, well, at least the kind of chicks that Freddy dates.
I was going to say, yeah.
Oh, God.
Jack's confidence is soon struck down as Joan's jock boyfriend, Ron, played by David Rennan. He was on a film called The Education of Allison Tate in 86. He did Star Trek Next Generation in 87.
Yeah, he did.
And one of the movies that I found on his resume that I had no idea exist, K-9000. So you remember K-9-1-1, K-9-P-I, the Jim Belushi dog movies?
Yes.
There's apparently a TV sequel called K-9000.
Is it in the future?
I don't know. It didn't look like it, judging from the clothes on it.
I know what our next podcast is going to be about.
So Ron the jock asks, what is this, show and tell? And Joan tells Ron to drop it before walking off, leaving him with Jack, who is then asked, what, can't you get a real one? Before calling over his jock buddies that lift Jack up, pulling down his shorts to expose his boxers, stating, huh, guess not, before walking off.
Now, I want to mention.
Yeah.
Now, did you mention we're in the gym now, right?
We are in the gym,
we're at the gym now.
Oh, and for the record, we're not at Springwood High. We're at a college.
We're at Springwood College.
Yes.
So, well, first of all, their gym is gargantuan.
Huge.
And it's almost confusing to me. With kids in such great shape, it's surprising they keep dying in their sleep all the time. But those two goons that lifted him up, like, what the fuck did they major in? Eating raw liver and steroids? Like, they were just monster. Like, these were like Venice Beach Iron Men.
Motions them over with his fingers, like, "Hey, come here!" And they both know what they're doing. They just he puts two thumbs up in the air, lifts them up, and then just pulls his pants down.
Well, I mean, everybody knows what to do with a Melvin. Dude.
Clearly, yes, we've all seen Weird Science. So they pulled down his shorts, exposing his boxers. He says, I guess not, and walks off. Later that night, Jack sits in the dark of his studio, simmering over the events, when Peter leaves a message on his machine and tells him, don't sweat it, kid. The pen is mightier than the sword.
No, it's the penis mightier than the sword.
Mightier.
That's what my captioning said.
Oh, Jesus. Telling him they'll talk about his first cartoon tomorrow before hanging up. Inspired by Pete's words, Jack goes to sketching a cartoon. We can't see it first, but seems to be getting real enjoyment out of his work. Once it's finished, the cartoon reveals a jock character resembling Ron, who's stating he wants to be bigger, putting a bike pump into his pants and pumping it until the last bubble is showing a kaboom, where his crotch is and the figure saying, whoops!
So what you're saying is he blew up his Johnson.
He blew up his Johnson.
Okay.
So the cartoon's finished, and Jack looks down and is amused. The next day, the cartoon is published, causing laughter all across the campus, all except for Ron, who crumples a newspaper and throws it to the ground, walking off angry. Then Jack is seen exiting the school, rounding a set of stairs, runs right into Ron, who begins to beat him up and throws him to the ground as he states, let's see how well you draw with hamburger for a hand, which you heard in the intro.
Yeah, and I gotta say, you know, it's good to weaponize your art.
Yeah.
I mean, good kudos to him, but might have been better off making it into a stabbing weapon, the piece of paper, because, he just knocked him down and pipsqueaked
him. He beats the shit out of him, in a matter of 10 seconds.
I like that, though. I was kind of surprised. I thought that the direction we were going to go was he was going to actually, really hurt his hand.
Yeah.
So he couldn't draw anymore. Yeah. But then, as you're about to find out, the rest of the episode is about him drawing.
Yes.
Well, the rest of the A story.
The rest of the A story, yes.
Go on, W.
So he asks him how he's going to draw with hamburger for a hand. He slowly brings his foot down on Jack's drawing hand before walking away. And then we cut to Freddy, who's in his domain doing finger painting. And by finger painting, I mean he's using his glove. As he comments, Jack's about to enter my drawing room, where I'm sure he'll find plenty of inspiration.
Oh, my God. Freddy finger painting? This is the best day of my life. This is the best.
And of course, it's red paint.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, he's a very bold artist.
Very bold
artist.
He's
in his red phase.
God.
He's like Picasso in every way.
Better than his rape phase.
Oh, that never ended. I mean, even death couldn't stop it, apparently.
Could not. We then see Jack back in a studio hanging a freshly drawn image of a big, bulking character with a white mask and large pecs outside of a large trench coat. Jack names him the Phantom and states, relentless, powerful, a merciless Avenger. He lives in the steam tunnels underneath the campus, waiting.
And he looks like the Phantom of the Springwood Opera.
He looks like Eric's Revenge, the Phantom of the Mall.
The Phantom of the Mall. Oh, that movie. I'm just saying, like, the mask, he does. I was almost sad that we didn't get introduced to Springwood Opera.
Right.
I'm sure there's a Springwood Opera House.
It's gotta be.
It's gotta be.
I'm sure it'll
come. Right next to the International House of Pancakes and the and the UN building, the you UN know, building. Like because they have everything.
So Jack then yawns, laying his head down on his desk till he's awoken with the sound of thunder, turns to see the image of the Phantom is now whited out, missing, and Jack walks over to the picture, which begins to surge with a red electrical glow. Suddenly, a hand reaches from behind and startles Jack as he turns to see the Phantom standing before his very eyes, played by Judd Omen. He has a resume that I was really impressed with. Serpico, Red Dawn, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, he plays Mickey in that, Howling 2, and Chud 2, just for some mentions.
Man, we had a lot of Chud 2 alumni,
really
too.
So he states loudly before laughing maniacally that he's relentless, powerful, merciless Avenger. Jack runs away but is told by the Phantom not to fear him because he's his protector, his child, and reminds him the pen is mightier than the sword.
Penis. Mightier than the sword. I like that. I like the Phantom because he talks like a pro wrestler.
That's exactly what I was
saying. I am
say.
Your child, your Phantom, and I'll see you October 15th at the Springwood Rec Center for the main event in a steel cage.
He really is having good fun with this role.
Oh, yeah. No, without a doubt.
So Jack asks him what he wants, and the Phantom asks him back exactly that same question, telling him together they will get everything Jack wants, everything he deserves, before laughing more, of course.
Well, Jack, you gotta laugh.
Jack argues this isn't real, and the Phantom fires back with saying it is real because this is Jack's revenge, and tells him to draw the man who beat him up.
I thought it was Eric's revenge.
We could only hope. So he says to draw who beat him up, feel where he is, and draw him. Jack begins to sketch quickly, Ron on a treadmill back in the gymnasium. The Phantom encourages him to draw what he desires, and it'll be set free by his own hands, and repeats Jack to draw.
An artist with powers from his drawings. Stamp that one off your anthology cliche bingo card, David.
Corman's Calamity from Tales from the Crypt.
Hey, I got a bingo. Well, not really. I never win anything. I mean, you knew that.
I did know that. Yeah. So the Phantom then tells him to draw the Phantom into the comic, which Jack then sketches the Phantom's hand, pulling a lever on the side of the treadmill. We then cut to Ron, who's running on the treadmill as the Phantom's hand comes into reality, pulling the lever that sends Ron falling onto the treadmill and is suddenly covered with blood as the machine whirs on with Ron's screams in the background.
Have you noticed how dangerous treadmills are in Springwood?
Is it the second or the third?
The second time.
Okay.
This is the second time a treadmill has hurt somebody or killed somebody.
So, the next morning, Jack wakes up in his room, convinced the whole thing with the Phantom was a dream. He makes his way over to his desk, where he sees the cartoon of Ron being ripped in half on the treadmill and comments that he doesn't remember drawing that. Pete is next seen walking in with Jack, commenting on the comic, stating, yeah, blood sells, they'll eat this up.
And it's so goofy. I mean, he's cut in half, and he's like, whoa!
Yeah.
It's really cartoony.
He says he's gonna call it No Pain, No Gain, and Jack asks him if he thinks it's a little over the top, but Pete tells him that nothing is safe in satire, which that's such a good line.
I mean, that's a pretty good line. But of course, as they arrive on campus.
Yeah, Jack states he doesn't know where the idea came from, but Pete tells him to keep him coming and maybe he does his best work when he's been pushed too far. Jack worries about upsetting Ron, but is interrupted then by the sound of a siren as there's multiple cruisers and an ambulance parked outside of the college. Jack and Pete run up to see what the commotion is and are informed by a student that Ron had a tragic accident on the treadmill, tearing him in half.
I guess he was in the middle of a really long workout, got tired, decided to split.
God damn you. Upset, Jack runs away and runs into an upset Joan, who tells him sorry for what happened to Ron. He lends down to help her pick up the books that he spilled. Joan tells him it hasn't quite hit her yet, and Jack apologizes, stating he didn't know this would happen. Joan questions how anyone could know, and Jack offers to walk her home. Joan accepts the offer until she picks up Jack's treadmill drawing. Disgusted, she slaps him, asking how sick he could find, or how sick and how could he find out what happened and then draw this. Jack tries to argue that he drew the first without knowing, but Joan wants to hear none of it and tells him to stay away from her, calling him a twisted creep as she walks away.
Well, you know, from her perspective, it really does just look like he did a comic to riff on the gruesome accidental death of her boyfriend. So I guess that would
turn
you off.
Off
a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Just a smidge.
So later in the studio, Jack rips off the treadmill drawing, but is suddenly told, no! As the Phantom screams in his studio, the Phantom tells him not to stop, not now. Jack tells him to stop calling him father, but the Phantom adds that Joan is better off without Ron now, and Jack should know this. In his heart, he knows.
Is this the Walt Disney origin story? So if this comes back and this kid has a mustache in the next scene, I nailed it then.
So the Phantom tells, Jack asks the Phantom what he is, and he tells Jack he is for him, just like Joan. She's for him, too. The Phantom tells Jack to draw what he wants. He has talent, and this is the only way that he can get her back. It's his gift, his only gift, and he shouldn't be left behind while others get what they want when he has such power with his drawings.
Oh, yeah.
That Phantom is really pumping Jack up.
He is building him up quite a ways.
So he adds that he will not let Joan see him, the real him. Jack tells the Phantom he is not to hurt her, to which Joan tells Jack he's under his control. Jack begins to draw as the Phantom orders, and Jack sketches Joan in the school showers, but quickly draws the Phantom in as well at the showers.
Oh, wait. So now we're in the college shower.
Yes, we are. So we're in the shower. Joan feels the presence of another asking if someone is there. Jack continues drawing as suddenly the Phantom appears in the locker room and grabs Joan, taking her away. Once finished at the drawing, Jack looks down to see the sketching of the Phantom dragging Joan away into the underbelly of the school before closing the sketch pad. In the basement, the Phantom chains Joan to a pipe in the basement as Joan pleads for him to let her go because she's claustrophobic and cannot deal with tight spaces. I wonder if that'll come back.
Doubtful.
Yeah, probably not. The Phantom comments on her pain and Joan claims that she's never hurt anyone until the Phantom loudly interrupts her, telling her that she has hurt someone, stating every time she's neglected a look that she inspired, she's caused hurt.
He sounds like an incel who reads a lot of Shakespeare in this scene. He's just like, you need to understand what you did to him by not returning his feelings. It's like,
I feel like the Phantom in this day and age would definitely have a blog about his feelings.
No, he wouldn't. He'd just be on 8chan.
Or Q.
I don't know about that. I think 8chan is where he would belong.
She continues to beg him as the Phantom tells her he's going to take away her advantages one by one before sealing her into the closet in the pipe she's chained to. The next morning, Jack is awoken by knocks at his door as Pete tells him he's over a half hour late for his cartoon deadline. Jack apologizes for oversleeping, but Pete tells him no problem, as long as he keeps producing great stuff, commenting that his latest comment is pretty kinky, and asks about the new character as he looks at the Phantom. Pete adds they could use this in the next expose, and Jack looks down to remember drawing of Joan and races off to the college locker room to find Joan. In the locker room, Jack runs into Sherry, who was played by Irana Irvine. She was in Fright Night, which the original.
Oh, was she the prostitute?
I think so, yeah. She was listed as girl.
Yeah, probably the prostitute.
Yeah, and she was also in the Ron Perlman series Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, wow. I remember that.
She asked Jack if he's trying to find inspiration for his next piece. Jack asks her if he's seen Joan, and Sherry tells everyone is looking for Joan, including her, angrily before walking off. Jack begins to walk around the locker room, but returns to his studio. He tries to erase the drawing of Joan and the Phantom, but has no luck. Suddenly, the drawing explodes, vanishing, but a gurgling sound begins to sound on the desk as the Phantom's hand reaches out of a pile of muck, pulling him into the discarded drawing.
Now, this is an important thing to point out.
Yes.
So the way it grabs him is very similar to the effect in Nightmare on Elm Street 1.
Yes.
Where it's like stretches and stretches and stretches.
Yeah.
But then when he gets pulled into the board, it's very like the effect in Nightmare on Elm Street 3 when Nancy sits on the chair and falls
goes into
through.
It, yes.
It's like they combine two of the most memorable effects from Nightmare on Elm Street 1 and Nightmare on Elm Street 3 into one moment. And I kind of dug it.
Oh, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was really neat.
No, there's some really cool effects in this episode. So, pulls him into the drawing and, excuse me, I lost my place here.
I'm so sorry about Louis.
Yeah, shut up.
Oh, by the way, he's Louis now.
I am not.
He's Louis now.
I'm not. The Phantom welcomes Jack into his world, but Jack immediately asks him where Joan is and what he has done to her. The Phantom asks him, what have you done? Jack tells him that he tricked him before the Phantom punches him, calling him a coward for not taking ownership of his creativity. Jack tells the Phantom that he created him and he can erase him just as easy. Like a bad sketch. The Phantom tells Jack he cannot erase his mind, and that's where he's from. Jack runs away down a tunnel and takes out his sketch pad, drawing the tunnel he just ran down. The Phantom then appears at the end of the tunnel, and Jack sketches a hole for the Phantom to drop into in the drawing. The Phantom begins to approach Jack, laughing maniacally, but then falls into the hole, which is now in reality.
Whoa!
The Phantom clutches the side of the pit, telling Jack, no, father, as Jack begins to erase the Phantom in the drawing till he disappears.
He erases his fingers
that are holding
himself,
yes,
because he's like hanging onto this hole in the ground. So he erases his fingers that makes him let himself drop, yeah.
So suddenly, Joan begins to call for help from the closet. Jack races to find her. He opens the door, revealing Joan, who pleads to be let out and that she can't take it anymore. We then see Jack, who is now decked out in the Phantom's clothes and mask, as he takes off the mask. Joan calls to Jack and asks him to let her go. Jack pleads that it wasn't him who took Joan, it was the Phantom.
It was the Phantom.
Joan tells Jack there is no Phantom, it's only ever been him. It's always been him. We then hear Pete call for Jack, and Jack looks up to see Pete's face is now peeking over a comic outline of Jack's desk, revealing that Jack is now inside one of his own comics.
Uh-oh.
Jack pleads to Pete, but he doesn't hear him. Pete looks down, commenting, "Damn it, Jack, why'd you do it? Looks like you needed more help than I thought." The camera then reveals a Star Times newspaper on Jack's desk with the headline, "Missing Co-Ed Found, Police Nab Artist Captor," next to a drawing of Jack calling for help. And that is the end of the A story as we cut to Freddy, who's painting from a gory selection of paints, commenting, "Jack wanted the good life, but he painted himself into a corner where he met one of my buddies." As Freddy then reveals a painting of the Phantom, which he then begins to cut up by digging his claws into his eyes.
Because why wouldn't he?
Why not?
I mean, and I like that we're seeing the softer, more artistic side of Freddy Krueger.
I want to see the hangout scene between the Phantom and Freddy, like where they're just catching up.
Yeah. "Let me tell you something, brother. You're weird." That's it. That's the entire scene. And scene.
So that's the end of the A story. Henrik, would you like to explain the A story?
For those
story?
Who are not aware or are not as entrenched in Freddy's nightmares as you and I, every episode of Freddy's Nightmares is an A story and a B story. Now, unlike the most traditional sense of an A story and B story, where they're congruent, the A story ends and then the B story continues. That way, in some markets, they could air the show as one half an hour show instead of one 1 hour show.
Some of these episodes of the one of the A story are very anticlimactic and depressing.
I mean, that's my favorite part. But but because of that, we are about to enter into the B story.
Yes,
which has a relatively new cast of characters this time around, except for the lead.
Except for the lead. So the B story begins outside of a mental hospital, not unlike the one we saw in Black Tickets. I think they use the exact same exterior. Mm. We cut to the office of Dr. Martell, who is played by Leland Cook, who is in FX2.
All right. Now we're cooking with gas.
Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Now that's my homie.
And this is where we know he was a TV player, NYPD Blue, JAG, and he also was on the remake of The Odd Couple.
Wow. Okay. So he's a journeyman.
Yes.
Wow.
So he asked Joan what he calls the $64,000 question, still having nightmares about being buried alive, which, what an opening question.
I mean, I would be off put if you walked up to me.
Yeah.
Like I opened the front door and they went, "Hey, Henry, how you been? You still have nightmares about being buried alive?" I'd be like, maybe.
I wasn't.
I am now.
So Joan tells the doctor, "No, that's all ended weeks ago," to which he replies, "Good answer. If she would have said something otherwise, they might have had to keep her locked up for a few days." Which he says with a smile,
well,
mind
he's being
you.
Playful.
Yeah. So Joan comments that she's anxious to get back to her normal life. The doctor reminds her to take it slow. She was kidnapped and held captive for some days, so the feeling of paranoia, claustrophobia, and the fear of entrapment are all possible as she goes into her recovery. Joan tells him she'll be fine, and the doctor tells her that if she experiences paranoia, migraines, lingering sense of dread, to contact him immediately.
Tingling while urinating.
Joan like jokes that he described the everyday life of citizens in Springwood, Ohio, which, yeah.
I mean, that's not unfair.
The doctor tells her that he's not joking and to be serious. He then gives her a prescription, telling her to stay home the entire weekend, take it easy, relax, order food in, just make sure that she doesn't overdo it. We then cut to Freddy.
Hold on. I'm kind of, my mind's kind of blown. This doctor might be the first adult character to ever even vaguely try to take care of a younger person.
Yeah.
Every other person is like, it's like, something horrible's happening. Like, you need to go to sleep.
You need to go to sleep.
You need to sleep.
Here's these
pills.
But
I'll die in my sleep. I gave you sleeping pills while you weren't looking. What? It's like, you know, I'm afraid somebody will kill me. I'm killing you, you know? Like, I'll die in my dreams. No, I just stabbed you. It's the adults in Springwood.
Well, it reminds me of I can't remember which episode it was specifically, but the one with the deadline, story and deadline, where the girl was adamantly telling her parents that she didn't want to sleep and also didn't like the medication because it made her zombie. Like, no, take your pills.
Keep taking your pills, dear. Mother knows best.
So we cut to Freddy, who's come around a corner of his domains, which, fuck. I love this so much. Hey, I'm okay. You're okay. But our Joni, she's skating on real thin ice. Think I'll stick her in a couple of tight places.
And finally, we are back to Freddy's roots of prodding people's trauma like an undercooked pot roast.
Really?
Which is, I mean, Freddy does that in the movies, but in the series,
he's fucking brutal.
Freddy's just like, hey, I noticed your father died when you were six. Here he is having sex with George Bush. You know, and you're like, what? Freddy, stop this.
It's just, I love when Freddy goes, hey, like anytime he starts his intros with that, like, just it fucking tickles
Well,
me.
Don't forget that every time Freddy is in his domain, he's talking to us.
Yes.
He's not, he's breaking the fourth wall.
He's breaking the fourth wall.
And as you know, it sounds like a great idea until it actually happens.
Yeah.
Keep it down. So, keep it down.
Joan returns home and finds her house is empty. She calls to Sherry, but she gets no answer till Sherry emerges from a corner shouting, "Welcome home," as she reveals a surprise homecoming party for Joan.
Aww.
The two hug each other as Sherry walks Joan into the living room of guests. Later that night, Joan and Sherry are sitting alone on the couch discussing her capture by Jack. Sherry comments that she's happy to have her home, and Joan adds, "It's good to not be in the hospital." Sherry comments she's tough for being kidnapped and spending all that time in the hospital recovering, and Joan states it wasn't that bad, then adds, the hospital, I mean, before Sherry asks if her claustrophobia is cured. Joan adds there is really no cure for claustrophobia, and the hospital just tried to help her deal with it. She then pops the top of the pill bottle on her meds, taking a few, and Sherry adds that they let her come home, so that must mean she's okay. Sherry asks if she wants to come with her and Brad on a ski trip, but Joan states she better not, as she's too clumsy to ski. Sherry tells her that she's going to get ready for the trip and tells Joan not to stay up too late. And Joan tells her that shouldn't be a problem as the pills make her drowsy.
Well, it's true. You know, you'd think after all of this trauma that Joni would like go to her parents or her parents would come to her. But no, I mean, they probably just mysteriously died in their sleep or something random like that, you know?
And the one thing I'll say about this, about Joan in particular with this episode is that you feel so bad for her because it's like you can tell that she's trying, but like there's definitely a sense of I don't even know what the word I want to use is, but she's so
penis,
penis. There's like a sense of dread with her that keeps kind of tipping her over, which we'll get to in a second. But
oh, you mean severe trauma?
Severe trauma.
Oh yeah, Dave. Yeah, yeah. No, no. She's been severely traumatized, David.
And they do not go lightly on that.
No, they don't. No.
So Joan gets
it's
up
brutal.
And walks past a dark closet, walking up to it and shutting the door. The next morning, Sherry asks again if Joan wants to go on the trip with her, but Joan tells her that she's looking forward to having some time to herself without doctors swarming her all over. Sherry goes into the closet as the phone rings. She goes off to answer, asking Joan to get her skis out of the back of the closet. Joan approaches the dark closet carefully and turns on the light inside. Grabbing Sherry's skis, she begins to hyperventilate before pulling them out and going over to the window, which she opens for fresh air. Joan is then interrupted by a knock on the door as Brad, played by David Reynolds, whose first, this is his first credit.
Ooh.
His resume consists of That's My Bush.
I remember that show.
I remember that show too. Crossing Jordan, but he's most notably known as Richard Wick in House of a Thousand Corpses. He's one of the two guys in the very beginning that get shot by Captain Spaulding and the guy in the opening robbery.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the one they make fun of, the little Dick Wick played with his stick. That's him.
Wow, it all started
so,
at Freddy's Nightmares.
We meet Brad and his cousin Jamie, who's played by Andrew Rapardo. He was Carl in Deadly Friend, the Wes Craven film.
All right. Yeah, and so he went from one of Wes Craven's lesser known things to Wes Craven's greatest accomplishment, Freddy's Nightmares.
Freddy's Nightmares.
Yeah.
So
do you think Wes had seen a single episode?
I feel like if anything, he probably watched Toby's episode because him and Toby were pretty good friends to my knowledge.
Yeah, and yeah, he probably watched that one.
I feel like any of the ones that his buddies were intertwined with, so probably like Mick Garris's episode, Toby's episode. I think like those are the only two that I can think of.
I doubt he watched Mick Garris.
He probably
episode.
Didn't.
I would pay, I mean, infinite money. Especially, it would have to be infinite money because Wes Craven has passed away. But
yeah.
I would pay infinite money to watch Wes Craven watch Lori Petty get her head cut off by a ribbon. And be like, this is from you, Wes.
I mean, to be fair, speaking of Deadly Friend, he does have a woman get like annihilated with a dodgeball.
That's true.
I mean, her head explodes in that movie.
Wes is a fascinating dude.
He really is. R.I.P. Wes Craven. We miss you.
We do.
So, Brad and Jamie, his cousin, Brad states he's giving Sherry and him a ride to the train station, or Jamie is giving a ride to the train station. Brad tells him he's going to go find Sherry and walks off, leaving Jamie and Joan to talk. Jamie offers to drop them off and come back to get Joan for dinner, but Joan tells him she has things to do around the house. The three of them leave, and Joan locks up. Returning to the closet, she goes in to shut off the light, but the open window that she had for the fresh air earlier suddenly blows the door shut, locking her in. Joan begins to then freak out and tries to gain control with a counting exercise, but suddenly the walls start closing in on her, and Joan screams in terror.
You know, the way the closet starts to shrink, it reminds me a lot of looking for apartments in New Jersey.
I could see that.
Because, like, after you get there, magically the square footage just keeps reducing, but the price never changes.
They can't all be Barbarian House. Well, Justin Long, you know, going downstairs.
I mean, if I lived in, if I had that Barbarian House in Jersey, I'd want as much square footage as possible too. I don't. It's so weird. I don't know anybody who is dying to live in Jersey.
Yeah,
but boy, is it expensive to live there. So
I get that.
I mean.
So after vigorously beating on the door, it opens up, releasing Joan. As she falls to the floor, she races to the phone and calls the doctor, but gets his answering machine. She leaves a message telling him she's having an episode and to call back when he can. Joan then ventures to the kitchen, taking out an entire chicken, but is interrupted by a knock at the door. Joan asks who is it and finds Jamie behind the door, who tells her that Sherry was going to loan him one of her textbooks and he forgot to get it before. He asks her if he can come in, adding he'll be quick, so Joan lets him in. Joan asks him where it is, and Jamie ask, where's what? Frustrated, Joan tells him she's not in the mood for jokes, and Jamie tells her he'll find it soon. Maybe first he'll use the bathroom, make a few phone calls, before he walks over to the closet, opening it and asking her, did he keep you in something like this?
Go to California, have a couple laughs.
Joan says, excuse me? And Jamie goes on to ask if he stuck her in a closet, or was it worse? Joan asks who told him, and Jamie adds Sherry, stating she thinks it's a real riot, which, that's a good fucking friend.
I gotta tell you, this guy might actually be worse at picking up women than you, Dave.
That's terrible. You're rude.
Oh, that is harsh on that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's trying his best, you know?
Shut up.
Now, tell him I apologize, please.
So, Joan demands for Jamie to get out, but Jamie adds they don't need to talk about it and that Joan can instead show him as he begins to play with her hair. Jamie goes on asking what the guy did to Joan before shouting, where is it? Startled, Joan asks what, and Jamie reminds her he said he had to go to the bathroom. Joan tells him it's down the hall as he walks off. Joan races to the phone, but is interrupted by Jamie, who asks, who is she calling? Joan states her doctor and that she thinks it's time for him to go. Jamie angrily grabs her, asking her if she thinks she can throw him out. Joan asks him why is he doing this, and Jamie composes himself, stating he just wants to hear the story of Joan's captivity. Because why not?
Because, I mean, that sounds good to me. Yeah.
Asking again.
I mean, when you meet someone new and you hear they have a significant trauma, like, you're like, hey, Dave, meet my friend Tony here. Tony, he was in Vietnam. I mean, how would you start your conversation with Tony? Hi, I'm Tony. You said your name is Louis?
I hate you. Hey, Tony, how's Vietnam?
Oh, God, I can still hear it. I can still hear them screaming. Yelling. It was hell. It wasn't like hell. It was hell. We were all in hell. Some died. They were the lucky ones. They were the lucky ones. So I heard you like movies. See, it's a perfect way to make a friend.
Perfect way.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect start. So... asking again, what did this guy do to you? Joan stays silent, and Jamie responds, it doesn't matter. It's nothing compared to what he's going to do to her. He takes her into the kitchen, demanding she cook for him, and Joan removes a plate of cold cuts from the fridge. Jamie grabs on Joan, calling her a tease, and tells her it's time to make a trip to the closet.
Yay!
He grabs on Joan again, but she quickly grabs a wine bottle, shattering it across Jamie's face. Jamie, in pain, sinks to the floor with blood above his eye. Joan then grabs a meat tenderizer, delivering another blow to his head, knocking him out to the kitchen floor. That was a nice hit.
It was pretty sweet. It was a gnarly wound on his head, too. Yeah. It was disturbing.
Yeah, no, when that bottle shattered, that was pretty intense. So Joan looks down at the injured Jamie, trying to compose herself, when suddenly a knock at the door sounds again. She opens the door to see Jamie acting completely different and kind. Joan slams the door, and Jamie begins to tell her he needs to pick up something before Joan interrupts, asking, "A book, right?" Jamie confirms, asking how she knew. Joan then approaches the now open closet and shuts the door. Jamie enters cautiously, asking if she's okay, stating that Sherry did mention to him her previous experience. Joan tells him she's fine and having trouble adjusting with her runaway imagination before excusing herself to the kitchen. Joan looks down to see the spot where she left the injured Jamie is now bare. She calls Dr. Martell again, but gets someone from his answering service. Joan argues that she doesn't need his answering service. She needs him.
Like, well, we're the answering service.
We get to him.
Yeah.
When Jamie off-screen tells her, "You're going to need a lot more than that, babe," as the camera reveals an injured Jamie from before in the doorway. Freaked out, Joan comments she's losing all touch with reality, which the operator asks, "Is that the message you'd like to leave, ma'am?" Before Joan hangs up.
What a dick. That guy knew. That guy knew that.
She looks back.
Yeah, better this way.
Oh my god. She looks back to see Jamie is gone. She makes her way over to the fridge, which begins to shake violently as a cooked chicken begins to fly at her.
And that made me laugh out loud because when I was writing this, I was literally cooking us a chicken.
Which was delicious.
Thank you. No, I'm a very good cook. But I was literally because I had texted you and I was like, "Hey, I'm roasting a chicken. You want you let's have dinner."
Yeah.
And you were like, belch, I don't know, bro. No, but you were like, "Cool, sounds good, bro." And then, so I'm like checking on it, and then I watch the show, and a cooked chicken jumps out.
Just flies.
And I lost my mind.
Oh my god.
And the best part was, this was the first time I'd ever roasted a whole chicken by myself, so it was just extra funny. I was like, "Oh, and now the roast chicken's attacking, okay."
So she forces the fridge door shut and is interrupted again by another knock at the door. Jamie is back asking for the book, and Joan tells him she's not home right now and to come back. Jamie suddenly turns evil again, stating, "No can do, Joanie," as he barges in. Suddenly, Joan takes a knife to his back, stabbing it as Jamie spins around to reveal it's Dr. Martell.
Ta-da!
Who falls to the floor, clutching her jacket. Freaked out, Joan sinks into the couch, and suddenly sees Jamie and Dr. Martell before her in front of mortuary freezers, and they tell her that she deserves special treatment.
So before we get to the big conclusion.
Yes.
Right before, at the last commercial break before this scene.
Yeah.
It finally happened. I got an ad for NyQuil.
Did you? Yes.
And I laugh my ass off. It's just watching 44 minutes of people falling asleep unknowingly and getting murdered. And then it's like the nighttime sniffling season coughing so you can have a good sleep medicine. Give it to your children if they're complaining about anything.
Good old Tubi.
Oh, I love it. Anyway, but no, so now they're in the morgue.
They're in a mortuary.
And now she is.
Yeah.
They're not in a mortuary. They're in a morgue.
Yeah.
So with the kind of the classic TV
classic
morgue with
freezers,
all the drawers for bodies.
Yeah.
And then she ends up in one of the drawers.
Yeah, she's on a slab, and Jamie adds, "Right this way, always room for one more." The two begin then to push Jamie into the freezer as she screams frantically. We then see Brad and Sherry return from the ski trip, calling to Joan, but there's no answer. Brad goes out to get the other bags, and Sherry goes into the closet door, which is stuck again, but pulls it open to reveal that Joan has put herself inside the closet with her hands above her head in a catatonic state, like when Jack captured her.
And, I mean, she's shaking and
she's
shivering,
shaking.
And her eyes are all gone. Oh, God.
Joan is next seen strapped to a gurney, being wheeled out by mental hospital staff back to the hospital. She passes Dr. Martell, who's telling Joan to take it easy the whole weekend, and Joan replies, "She'll be fine."
And that was so chilling and unexpected.
Yeah.
Because if you remember at the beginning of the show, there's she's talking with the doctor, a woman gets wheeled by who's screaming. So it's looping. So now not only is she being driven insane, she's going to be driven insane
forever.
Basically forever. I mean, I gotta say, Freddy gets more and more evil as time goes on.
Jesus.
And I also want to say something, because we're 18 episodes in to a 44 episode series.
Yes.
And the biggest complaint people have is that, you know, the show's not even about Freddy. Freddy is always established as the cause of whatever non-Freddy thing is happening. Like, the Phantom was Freddy messing with him. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. It was for budgetary reasons. Yeah. And to keep, but it was also to keep things fresh.
Yeah.
Because if every episode was just Freddy messing with teens, it would get old. I mean, they felt like it got old after six movies.
True, true.
For God's sake.
Yeah.
Now, you know, get old after 22 episodes a season. But also, I just want to say, like, but yeah, so, I mean, I love the idea that everything that happens, Freddy was like, you know, this time I just want to teach her a lesson about being nice to her mom. And you're like,
All right,
Fred. And he's like, what? I get bored.
Yeah.
But I found that sincerely chilling that she's being wheeled insane past herself. Also, I want to say we've had a lot of episodes end with somebody just being driven insane.
Yeah.
Now I get why Weston Hills is so big in Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Shit, though.
Apparently, Freddy must own stock in that company or be a board member or something.
Can you imagine him at the board meetings?
He's just carving the apple. He's like, here's what I think. Sleeping pills. It's just what's necessary. And people are like, aren't you a dead child molester? And he's like, and aren't you the former head of this board? And they're like, oh.
Pushes a button like Dr. Evil. Yeah,
and then they landed like, oh, no, I just fell on a big cushy mattress. Guess I'll take a nap. And he's like,
it's either that or like justified. It was already in the glass.
Oh, gosh.
So the episode ends as we cut to the man himself. The coffin is in the middle of a dark room as Freddy pops out stating, what's so bad about being buried alive? Beats being barbecued. Hold my calls.
And then he lays down.
Lays down and shuts the lid.
Because he's ready for a nice night's nap.
And that is The Art of Death, Season 1, Episode 18.
And there wasn't a whole lot of art in the second half.
No, there was not.
But I guess that's okay.
And we should have seen this coming.
Oh. Here comes Freddy. Hey, Freddy.
Hey, bitch.
How's it going, Freddy?
Oh, pretty good. I've actually been working on my finger painting and stuff like that. Well, people, they think of finger painting as just a thing children can do. I actually got it from a girlfriend of mine, but that's how I picked it up. But I don't know. I've just been doing art all day, and I don't know. I wasn't really planning on coming down and talking to you guys, but I heard I heard you belching off mic, and I just wanted to check it out.
That's fair.
But I'm trying to come up with something more to say about this episode, but I guess I'm drawing a blank. Okay, anyway, I'm sorry. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I really need to get the lead out.
Is that all? Is there more?
What? Is this all too sketchy for you? I'm very lonely. I'm very lonely.
We are sorry to hear that.
That's
Fred.
That's great, Freddy.
Are you even listening to me?
Huh?
Are you reading that book about the Holocaust again?
It's really good, Freddy.
That's weird. That's really weird and dark.
Anything else, Freddy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I found something when I was in the kitchen earlier. This is your pizza cutter, right, Dave?
Again? Ah.
Oh, don't be mad.
Now I have like 3 matching scars from this podcast.
Dave, that's 4.
That is 4. Well,
it's actually 5. Look in your pants.
Okay, Freddy.
Damn
we're gonna
it, Freddy.
We got to let you go, Freddy. We're running out of time on the show, okay? So thanks, Freddy.
Bye, Freddy.
I'm not a good person.
We know this. Boy, do we know this.
I'm so glad that Freddy takes time out of his busy schedule. Dude, you know, I thought he was never going to be on the show again after he got Hulu without ads.
Yeah. Honestly, I wouldn't be. Yeah, I get that.
I wouldn't show up to this shit if I could afford Hulu without ads.
All right, so let's rate this puppy.
Okay.
All right, so Freddy's interactions are top-notch in this. They are minimal, but just the right amount.
Well, him finger painting alone was just like killed. Because his paint, of course, finger painting with the claw.
Yeah.
So it killed me.
I know I mentioned this a lot, but that first story had such big Are You Afraid of the Dark vibes with the Phantom.
Yeah, no, it did. It did.
I definitely felt like that. The B story I thought was really great, really dark. So I'm going to give this a B-.
Whoa, you're going that high.
I'm going to go this high, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I was going to give it a C+.
I thought the reason I'm extending this a little, because with last week we talked about how the A story wasn't that great for... I'm blanking on the title. Love Stinks. With this, I thought both the A story and the B story were well-rounded.
I would agree with that.
I thought the characters were great. I thought the story was great. And overall, I think the nightmare stuff The only complaint I would have would be with the B story with being buried alive. I guess I was expecting kind of open grave.
To like bury her alive.
Yes,
at
like
some
burying
point.
Her yeah. alive at some point. But no, solid episode. B minus on my end.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a C plus. I did like it a lot. I thought the second story was pretty good. They did a good job considering they never left her apartment basically after the opening scene. I liked it. That chilling ending is really what got it to C plus for me instead of just C.
I get that.
But I mean, cause it wasn't a huge standout, but it was definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, this is definitely a good one. So that was a
fun one.
Well, we are going to be back next week, of course, with season one, episode 19, Missing Persons, directed by Jeff Frelick. He's, of course, the producer of 22 episodes, writer on 34 of them, and he did the story for Sister's Keeper.
All right.
So that is going to be a good one.
That's going to be fun.
I watched the promo ahead of time. I haven't watched the episode, and it looks wild.
Well, I want to. Oh boy. Well, I want to mention real quick. I have to mention it because I'd be remiss if not.
Yeah.
We talked about it last week too. My dog Chicano is currently going through cancer treatment, and I am looking for any help anyone is willing to spare, even $4. Right now, I've spent over $6,000 on his treatment. I put it on my credit cards. I'll live with it. But if you want to help, if you can help, all you have to do is go to helpchicano.com, help, and then C-H-I-C-A-N-O, Chicano, that's his name, and it's a GoFundMe, really could use some help. We're trying really hard to just offset that stress, but wow, I'm glad I could end it on an upbeat note.
He's a good boy, he's
like,
worth it.
It's going to be like Casey Kasem. We got to go down on a goddamn upbeat, up-tempo song with goddamn death dedication. It's fucking ponderous, man. Fucking ponderous. But you know what isn't ponderous, David?
What's that?
Sending us an email.
Yes.
At freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com. Write in. Let us know what you think. Let us know if there's some other Freddy Krueger media you want us to cover.
Hell yeah.
Let us know how you want us to celebrate the end of the first season.
Yes.
Because it's coming.
If you have any questions, too, we would honestly be open to doing a mailbag episode. So any questions you got, send them our way.
I don't want to talk about you and your mailbags. All right, well, we're going to get out of here, but thank you so much for listening to Welcome to Primetime. We'll be back next week with another trip to Springwood.
Oh, yes, we
will. Until then, stay sleepy.
Stay sleepy. Pass the night, Will.